This is House Committee on Water. We will start with the 5 p.m. meeting. We will then recess that meeting and restart the 8 o'clock meeting. We will finish that meeting and then restart the 5 o'clock meeting.
And if it doesn't, we just drop it from the schedule.
Okay. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the House Water Committee. This afternoon meeting. Glad to see you all here, and we're ready to do business. I think first on our agenda, we're going to have Representative Butler. And
you've got to close this morning's meeting. You're still in recess.
I don't have to close.
No, we're just recessed. Yes, now he's just dabbling us back.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Just so the record is clear, Representative Butler, let me make sure that the tape shows that this is a continuation of the 8 a.m. meeting on the 10th of April, 2003. With that, we should be in good shape, and Representative Butler is here. Oh, I beg your pardon, Representative. I can't talk to you. You're not on this morning's agenda. So
until I close this morning's meeting, and then we'll come to some.
Well, what do I have for agenda for this morning?
Nothing left. We just took care of that. If you want me to explain what happened to those bills that we talked about.
All right. Let's indulge us for 2 seconds here.
Sure.
Staff will inform us. We had several bills this morning that we were trying to work desperately with the chief clerk's office to make sure we were doing things by the numbers, and Pete will give us an update on that, and then we'll move on to the other agenda.
Mr. Chair, committee members, this morning we went into recess because we had two bills that we were concerned about related to having fiscals and not having fiscals. The first one was 2688 that related to the non-payment of royalties for certain fill. Although we passed that bill out of committee with a due pass to the floor, because we didn't have a fiscal impact statement early, that bill will still go by fiscal, and it's If it is given one, we haven't dropped it yet. If it is given a fiscal, we'll have to reconsider that quickly and change the movement back to ways and means. And we won't know that for a couple of days. So this will be rescheduled potentially for potential reconsideration on Tuesday. And if we get a fiscal, we'll have to reconsider. The second one was 2659, and we had a work session on that. We amended that bill, but we held on to it because, again, the sponsors and all wanted to avoid going to Ways and Means and go directly to the floor, which meant we would have to have rescinded the Ways and Means referral. To do that, we have to have evidence that would allow the speaker to consider doing so. So that meant we need to have a physical or a fiscal analysis, or at least whether it be a statement or not, to know. So what will happen now is I've turned in the information to fiscal. They will either tell us it will need a fiscal, it will have a fiscal, or it won't. If it has one, then we would move that to Ways and Means, and there's no other option. If there's not, and the new amendments make it not necessary, then we will refer it to the floor and ask the and ask to rescind Ways and Means. So we're just kind of waiting to get that done, and that's all be taken care of Thursday or Tuesday next week.
I think.
And that's all we have from this morning.
I think, Mr. Test, that the proper or the explanation on what will happen if it doesn't have a fiscal is simply that we will take the appropriate action.
Okay.
Whether that's to the floor or whether it is to continue to send it to Ways and Means will be yet to
that's
be determined.
That's a much simpler way of saying it. That's why he's here and I'm not.
Well, no, it's why I've had many conversations today about things that, believe it or not, 8 years I never 8 years ago I never dreamed I'd care about.
And that was okay. All that was left in that schedule this morning.
And that was all that was left, so we will close the the House Water Committee for the afternoon session on April 10, 2003. And at this, thank you, Mr. Representative Butler, for your patience and indulgence, and we can proceed with your testimony.
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I do appreciate your schedule and the difficulties that you've got, as you've got a great deal of legislation before you in these early days in this month. Colleagues, House Bill 2473. I'm for the record, I'm Tom Butler from House District 60. House Bill 2473, which we had discussed earlier, does two things. In the state of Oregon, we have a pilot program that allows directs the State Department of Fish and Wildlife to expend not less or at least 10% of the annual trout hatchery funds of the department on trout produced by private aquaculture facilities. And the second thing this bill does, that's the first thing that the bill does, is it moves that figure to it deletes at least 10 and moves it to at least 25% of that annual trout hatchery funds for the private aquaculture facilities for the production of trout. Second thing that it does, it happens on lines 7, 13 through 15, and on line 25, and that's to make the program, removes the pilot language and makes it permanent, repealing the sunset. Now, I mentioned in my first testimony to you back in February, the early part of February, that the department has not worked all the best with some of the private hatcheries, and that we've struggled to find what is 10% of the annual trout hatchery funds of the department. Finally, in Ways and Means, the department and the folks in Ways and Means arrived at the number. I think that number is something under $300,000 for 10%, and that commensurately more than that would then be expended if we increase this to 25% and stopped raising or stopped expending as much as we are presently expending in the current hatcheries of the state. The concern that I expressed then and I bring to you again now is that the cost of hatchery trout produced by the state hatchery is roughly 2.5 to 3 times that of that which can be procured privately. Since we last met, there's been ample evidence and even some newspaper articles that appeared in February and March that given an opportunity to have better trophy opportunities to fish, that anglers and hunters would be willing to pay additional increases in their angling fees. So with that, colleagues, I just give you the opportunity to go ahead and, number one, by expending 15% more in the private aquaculture, and which would be 15% less in the state's system, that we would roughly double this 25% that would be expended on private hatchery-grown trout would basically double the fishing opportunities for anglers in the state of Oregon. And I think that you could anticipate that there would be a rather considerable increase in those folks who would be willing to buy the fishing licenses for these opportunities. And then speaking to the second, and that second issue, which is the repeal of the sunset, one of the problems that we have is the contracting for these fish. They have to be contracted over a biennium for a 2-year period. It's sometimes difficult, and that language has become cumbersome. There's bonding issues and those kinds of things, which have become a source of contention. And so I would encourage your approval of both of those issues and look forward to hearing from the Department of Fish and Wildlife as to any concerns, ongoing concerns that they may have.
Thank you. Are there questions for Representative Butler? And I know we're in work session here, so thank you, Representative.
Chair, members of the committee.
I'd like to ask Mr. Elliker to come up. Roy, does the representative's testimony refresh your memory at all on House Bill 2473?
For the record, Mr. Chair, my name is Roy Elliker, Deputy Director of the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, and Mr. Chair, yes, Representative Butler's testimony I've heard before, and I think we did provide testimony before as to the cost of this bill for the department and the hatchery programs. I did not come prepared to testify today again on the bill. I thought we had given our testimony, and I'm not sure, Mr. Chair. I guess maybe I missed the signal here or something.
No, that's okay. We're still okay in terms of time. And I don't mean to be dominating this, colleague. If you have some questions in a minute, that'll be fine. We'll get there. But I'm a little concerned. I'm looking at the fiscal on this, and what we're getting shows a $420,000+ fiscal. Have you seen that? Are you aware of that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we're very aware of that, sir, and I thought we had testified that that is what our estimated amount fiscal would be to hatchery programs if the bill became law.
Am I right that you did the work for fiscal on this? And they,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, and yes. In fact, I think in our actual testimony that we provided, myself and Mr. John Thorpe, back on March 20th, we estimated that to increase the that the current amount of money that we spent that we spend on private trout hatchery purchases is $279,000 currently. That's current for the 2001-03 biennium. And that if we spent 2.5 times that amount, it would push our purchases up to nearly $700,000 for the, say, if it passed into law for the 03-05 biennium, and that this substantial increase in expenditure would necessitate reduction in other ODF&W hatchery programs. And the $400,000 fiscal, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, comes from the math of the fact that we're going from $279,000, which is what we received through Ways and Means to cover purchases this biennium, to the increase of $700,000 under the bill. So the difference between that is approximately $400,000, and that's the amount that you see submitted to fiscal, and I thought we had testified to that on March 20th.
But I guess my question would come back to we understand that it costs you more money for the hatchery for the private hatchery thing.
Yes.
I think Representative Butler would generally agree with those figures that probably plus or minus some change of what it would cost to contract to buy them. The thing that seems to be excluded in this $420,000 if I don't have a lot of expertise here, but if I look at this, it looks to me like the costs that the department would have to provide the same number of fish, which the question, of course, comes down to whether or not there's a, we can directly deduct those costs the department would have, or whether there's only some portion of that department cost that we could deduct. Do you understand where I'm going with that?
Mr. Chair, I'm afraid I do not know where you're going with that.
I'm not where I'm going. Do you understand what the question is?
Mr. Chair, I guess I don't understand the question.
Well, if 25% are funded.
Yes.
And that's an increase of 15%.
Yes.
As such. It must cost you something, the department. And we'd be happy to have you pay for it instead of the department, but it must cost the department something to produce that 15% now.
Yes, sir.
So has that cost that the department would have to produce that 15% been deducted from this? I mean, it sounds to me like we've taken figure the cost based on if we'd have to contract out for $700,000 plus or minus some change.
Yes, sir.
And we get it down to 400 because we currently are at 10%, and that costs us $279,000. Mm-hmm. B from A comes out to $420,000.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't include, that arithmetic doesn't include what your cost would be to produce those. And I'd like to ask you to, you know, sometime before Tuesday, to get some kind of numbers run through on that, if you would, for me, so I get some sort of an estimate, you know.
Mr. Chair, I'll come prepared on Tuesday. I apologize for this evening. I'll come prepared on Tuesday to have a much more in-depth discussion. I had brought, actually, for Representative Krupp, but he's not here tonight.
Yeah.
At his request, I brought some hatchery costs, but since he wasn't here and he asked for it directly, I was going to wait and meet with him and then provide that to him. But I'd rather come back on Tuesday with our hatchery program leader, and we can have a more in-depth discussion of program costs if that is needed.
Appreciate that, if we could. We will talk between now and then to make sure we're kind of on the same page and going the same direction.
Thanks. I'll be sure to come by tomorrow, Mr. Chair, if that's okay.
That is not okay. Make it Monday.
All right, I'll do that. Thank you.
Between now and Monday, the chair has canceled all of his appointments, and his scheduler would be very irritated if I suddenly came along and started adding appointments.
Mr. Chair, far be it for me to irritate your chief scheduler and wife.
Yes. Thank you, Roy. I knew you'd see it my way. Tom, is that okay? And we'll talk between now and then, too.
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate
sure.
it.
Thank you, Representative. And at this point, we will call. We have the honor and privilege of having not only a bipartisan, but a bi-house members of the legislature here to testify, and my assumption is we're here on the same bill.
This is really scary.
Thank you. If we could, Senator Dukes and Representative Krieger. But before doing that, I'm advised that we should close the hearing on House, or the work session on House Bill 2473, and you got me confused.
Sorry.
Thank you.
And now we're opening up the hearing. Right?
And we're opening a work session on House Bill 3108.
Senator Dukes, it's always nice to see you.
Aren't we on 31?
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm with
Mr. Chair, I figured it out when I
could. We have Mr. Rowletter come up too.
Yeah, I think so. I think that'd be okay.
We need somebody in between them. Anyway,
we need.
So.
I really wanted it to be, you know, just the bipartisan.
Next to each other, didn't
you? Too much fun, Joe.
We got to have fun at night. I mean, you know, we can't take all of this too seriously.
After 5 o'clock.
Yes, after 5 o'clock. I mean, that's only fair. Give us an update of where we're at on this, if you would, please, Pete.
I thought you were going to skip that. Okay. House Bill 3108 requires persons operating vessels for landing black rockfish, blue rockfish, or near shore fish to obtain permits. Establish qualifications for obtaining permits, creates permit fees and landing fees, establishes rockfish, black rockfish, blue rockfish, near shore species research account, establishes lottery system for issuing permits, defines black rockfish, blue rockfish, and nearshore fish, appropriates money to the state Fish and Wildlife for research on black rockfish and blue rockfishery and near species fishery, becomes operative January 1st, 2004, declares emergency, effective upon passage. There are amendments 3108-3, which possibly make all of that jargon that I just went through no longer exactly the same.
Okay, Representative Krieger, were you going to explain the -3 amendments for us?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I will.
please.
For the record, I'm Wayne Krieger, State Rep from District 1. Excuse me, I got a frog here. As you've been told, you have the dash 3s before you. I will address maybe some of the things that were presented when we presented the bill to you last week that seemed to have some conflict with the fishermen, Senator Dukes, and some others that had some concerns about part of the bill. And so we've tried to address those things. I think it's interesting to note we met, I believe, that afternoon right away. It was all fresh in our minds. And we had Senator Dukes present, Anna Husing from Oregon Coastal Zone Management, John Griffith, the Coos County Commissioner, Don Stevens from Fisheries, Paul Hanneman, Steve Cafori, staff of Representative Hobson, Joe Letter, who's sitting next to me here, Terry Thompson, County Commissioner, and Ray Monroe. So we went over the bill and tried to address those things that had concerns, so I'll do that. One of the things that came about to be recognized that the 15 pounds of incidental catch for the salmon shoulder possibly would not be adequate, depending on what type of fish they were taking part in, a good year, bad year, coho, nearshore, offshore, whatever it might be. And we came upon the fact that we could probably give them 30 blackfish or 100 pounds, which was ever greater. And the discussion continued, and we ended up doing that in the dash threes. But also we put the caveat in there that the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife may adjust the incidental criteria, the taking criteria, based upward or downward based on the rockfish stock assessments. So that was one of the things we thought was also very important. The same thing basically was with the trawl fishery, the big boats that use the nets that are offshore. Those boats at times might go 6 months or a year and never drag up a black rockfish, and then all of a sudden they may have 200, 500, or 1,000 pounds. And to avoid that waste, we thought we'd have the incidental catch go to 1,000 pounds, but instead of on one trip, it would be 1,000 pounds cumulative during the year. They could have up to that total amount. So if they happen to have 100 pounds or 50 pounds, and then later on 600 pounds, they would be allowed up to the 1,000. We agreed that that would be all right to move forward. There was some concern, and it's one of the things that we all struggle with. I know Senator Dukes, I know she struggled with it greatly, and the fact that we hate to take our fishermen that have been struggling for years and not allow them to be in a fishery. The dates that were originally in the bill were the dates that were adopted by the Department of Fish and Wildlife, January 1 of 97 through July 1 of 2001. So we took a look at what would happen if we went back 2 years. And we only went back 2 years because the Department of Fish and Wildlife only had records on black rockfish and blue rockfish from 94 or 95 forward. Before that time, they were just all categorized as rockfish and they weren't separated by species, so we couldn't identify fishers that took part in that fishery and actually qualified. As I recall, we picked up something like 18 boats in that fishery if we allow those boats in. And it was agreed that rather than exclude those people, that we would allow those boats in. I think that met her, most of her desires and the desires of the fishermen that were there. And yet I don't think it blows the limited entry part of the bill clear out of the water. Yeah, it may be a little bit difficult to get down to whatever number there is, but the Department of Fish and Wildlife has to set the number of boats in the fishery by January of 2004 anyway. So I think that will work real well. The other thing was that the 18 boats that came in that had the black rockfish, blue rockfish permit, there was concern about the transferability that some of those boats back in 95 on up to maybe 2000 or so had fished or not fished, were on the beach, and even though that boat qualified, they wouldn't be able to possibly transfer those permits at a time before they maybe even wanted to retire. And so we decided to go ahead and let those boats transfer those permits in so long as they were hit that criteria, the transferability for those new boats, the black rockfish. One of the other things that came up was there was some question about the increase in fees. And I mentioned to you last time that I felt that the industry had to step up and provide the revenue for marine research. And we did take it from the near 2%, I believe the figure was, or something of that nature, up to 5%. But you have to remember that when the fish are taken dead, if you take 5% of a dead fish worth 50 cents a pound, you know, that's different, 2.5 cents. A 3-pound fish is seven and a half cents that guy would be paying on that fish. But if that same 3-pound fish is up as a live fish, its value is so much more. It's going to be worth more. So the person who's going to get the high-value dollar will be paying the percentage. So it does distribute it out to those who are most able to pay because of the value of the fish. And I think, in closing, I think you could argue the point of whether you need a limited entry. I just don't believe personally that you can have, even though I'd love to see it, I'd like to see all my fishermen out there and have a great opportunity. But you dilute the pie. If you put too many people in it, nobody can make a living. You fish the resource down, and pretty soon you've got restricted landings. And we just got new restricted landings offshore for the drag fleet yesterday. And they're impacted. And they got to be out, I believe it's about 200 fathoms, I think it is, before they can fish now, just about. So these people are greatly impacted. And what I'm trying to do is to make sure that we can sustain that fishery so it's there for everybody, realizing that you can't have everybody in, but those that hit the qualifying dates and hit the poundage requirements, someone made up that, Department of Fish and Wildlife did, as far as the criteria. And we went along with that criteria, and we did some things in the bill, which I mentioned to you about transferability, second notice so they don't lose the license, a few things like that we think benefits the fisheries. If you have any questions, I can answer them.
Thank you. Let's hear from the other folks here. Senator Dukes, would you have any weigh in?
Sure. Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm Joan Dukes, State Senator from District 16. I'm going to be glib and excited at the fact that the two of us were here together and that neither of us disagreed with the bill, if you amend it, and that we were both still standing, indicated that you should move forward with this bill. And that's true, and I appreciate because when I was here before, I asked that we'd be able to get into the process, and I appreciate Representative Krieger's generosity and his patience in working it out with the fishermen that I represent and myself. And I think we've come to a legitimate proposal. I still wish we were only doing live fish. I wish we weren't trying to do limited entry for the dead fish fishery. It makes more sense to me, and it's something where there's more of a demonstrated need. There are pieces. It's a difference of philosophy between the two of us. I have and continue to believe that it's not up to the state board who gets to make a living. And when every time you do a limited entry that is not required because of some jeopardy to the resource, we are making a decision as to who gets to fish and make a living off of that and who doesn't. And so you can walk on any wharf around and you can have the same disagreement amongst fishermen and all of that, which is why they don't come to their own decisions very often on these. They turn to us. Having said all of that, if we have to do limited entry, this is not a bad way to do it. And we've managed to get a dory fisherman back into the bill, and we've managed to get, I think, all of the people who couldn't even make a claim to be legitimate black and blue rockfish fishers into the bill. And we've allowed transferability so that if somebody retires or dies, the widow can transfer the thing to something else. I had a constituent call one day who bought a new boat. You know, she'll be able to transfer it from the old one to the new one. So those things are all worked out, and Representative Krieger and I will continue to have some philosophical differences of opinion between the North Coast and the South Coast on fishing issues, but I'm here to tell you that if you adopt these amendments, that I'm not going to object to them.
Thank you, Senator. Let me editorialize a little bit and say that the chair really appreciates your coming to us and working with Representative Krieger on this. And I think this is probably one of those bills that's pretty much a classic illustration of, you can get to a meaningful place. Maybe nobody likes it 100%, but you can get to a meaningful place where fundamentally we are, you know, doing the best thing we can to protect the, in this case, the fishermen, but the citizens of the state of Oregon. So I do really appreciate your help and cooperation in working with Representative Krieger. And, you know, we rely very heavily upon those few of you who have a lot of expertise as far as the fish and ocean issues. And some of us are just, you know, kind of poor country farm boys. And some of us are
farm girls.
Farm girls. And some of us are kind of big city. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Will Rogers once said, when you find yourself in a hole, quit digging.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I have to admit, to be honest and forthright, I have mentioned to her that I do have 126 relatives in her district.
Oh, my God. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'm sure you will see us before you're battling again in the future.
Joe, did you have any comments?
Mr. Chair, my name is Joe Rollator. I live in Walport, Oregon. I've been helping draft this bill. And I would be here to answer any technical questions, if that's possible, from a standpoint of the fisheries and the fishermen. But I don't have anything else to add. Thank you, sir.
Does anyone have any questions of the... No. Seeing none, thank you very much. And we are in work session.
Mr. Chair.
And the chair would introduce or entertain a motion.
I move the Dash 3 amendment to House Bill 3108.
Representative Cruz moves the Dash 3 amendment to House Bill 3108. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3108 as amended to the floor. Does it have prior reference?
It's prior reference.
Okay. To the floor with a due pass recommendation with a prior reference to Ways and Means.
Representative Cruz moves House Bill 3108 as amended to the floor with prior reference to Ways and Means.
With
a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the main motion?
Mr. Chair, I'm just, I like this kind of compromise. So thank you both very much.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'll remember that.
Well, with some very specific exceptions. So.
Representative Cruz is especially fond of the compromises when it's two other members of the body.
Yeah, pretty much. Yes, you will.
Before we continue to dig these holes, we call a roll, please.
Representative Forrest.
Aye.
Representative Cruz.
Aye.
Representative Troffler.
Aye.
Representative Tomei.
Aye.
Representative Dingover.
Aye.
Representative Krupp.
Excused.
Chair Jensen.
Aye. My assumption is that Representative Krieger would like to carry the bill on the... we don't have a carry. It's gone to Ways and Means. My assumption is Representative Krieger will watch it in Ways and Means.
I believe he's not. You're on that sub, aren't you?
Yeah. Happy to be.
It's amazing how these things work out. Both of you, I know.
Thank you.
House Bill 3108 then is passed on to the Ways and Means. And we'll move to our next item of agenda and see if the chair can keep from digging himself in another hole. And open our work session on House Bill 2255. And
shovels over here. We
have heard this bill, as you will recall, members, and we had a fairly significant difference of opinion between the Department of Human Services and the League of Oregon Cities. And I am here to tell you that in the chair's opinion, that it is possible to have a miracle appear in this building.
I agreed with Representative.
We ask the two groups to get out and sit down and work together to try to come up with an amendment that would help us be able to deal with this issue. The issue is very real as far as the need to do more with a Clean Water Act or with clean water, drinking water. We are in, I don't think, imminent danger as far as the feds are concerned, or we might have chosen some other route, but we're certainly in a position where we could come under a scrutinizing eye of the federal government on the under the Clean Water Drinking Water Act. And I believe the folks did a pretty good job. Would anyone like to speak to the amendment, either from the League or the Health Department?
Mr. Chair, I was kind of Mr. Chair, I was kind of hoping to hear from Katie King on this one.
You always want to hear from Katie.
I know.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Gail Shibley. I'm the Administrator of Public Health Systems for the Department of Human Services.
Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm Willie Tiffany with the League of Oregon Cities.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, a miracle, if you will, has happened, perhaps a small M. We have seen the Dash 1 amendments, and not only do we agree with them, we like them even better with perhaps a friendly amendment, which I'd like to give to your committee administrator, which basically expands the task force to no more than 12 members in order to add up to 3 members representing other public water systems. So it would add a D, a sub D there on following line 10. And Mr. Chair, that simply would allow us to ensure that that there are other public water systems representatives a part of this task force, because the task is so critical. We want to make sure we have as many voices as appropriate around this table, so that we can come back in this report that's called for and work together and make sure that Oregonians remain in control of Oregon's drinking water.
The chair would like to. This is a little more of an amendment than we'd like to be able to do it, you know, here. And the chair would like to ask if you would be agreeable to trying to do this amendment on the Senate side.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we're at your beck and call. So we do believe that this has merit, and if it's not done here, particularly with the chair and the committee support, we'd be more than happy to push this over there as well.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I would agree. In my committee, I would probably conceptually amend, but you follow the rules better than I do.
Well, it's not that. I'm just,
But I think it'd be appropriate. I think the addition is appropriate to the task force, and I think I would recommend that a recommendation from the committee, sense of the committee, and sense of the chair on the amendment go with the file.
Mr. Chair, it had a prior reference to Ways and Means, and if it still had a reference
for a task force.
Well, but this is an amendment to the bill. The first bill called for.
Well, I know.
So we can rescind that now.
But
not to be a fiscal on amendments.
Well, we won't, but that's. The issue is the same one that we were dealing with this morning, as far as we're taking a bill that had a major fiscal, and we're amending it. To a point that it's a less of a fiscal, and I guess in relationship to this, we haven't heard from you yet, Willie. But just some questions before we get there. What's the composition of this task force, and Is this primarily one that is put together between the league and the Department of Human Services? And how much? It doesn't sound to me like we've got any really state money involved in this task force, or do we?
Mr. Chair, again, for the record, Willie Tiffany of the League of Oregon Cities. I can't answer on behalf of the state in terms of their fiscal for doing the setting up the task force. The bill directs the director of the Human Services, Department of Human Services, to appoint three groups currently, three representing the League of Oregon Cities, three representing special districts, and three representing the Department of Human Services. Ms. Shibley talked about the third conceptual amendment. We would support that. In the past, we have participated in this group, and we've made this mistake before. There are other public drinking water entities who committee members may think we represent or the special districts represent, but actually, as defined in statute, a private water company is a public drinking water system. For the purposes of this bill, a mobile home park, there are all sorts of different entities. So we would agree with those amendments to make sure folks get all the appropriate folks get to the table. And I'll let Ms. Shibley talk about the fiscal.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate the question because, in fact, we do need to be mindful that every time we're asked to be a part of a task force or a work group, clearly there's an opportunity, a cost, a staff cost involved. Frankly, there is nothing more important to our drinking water program than making sure that we have adequate resources available to maintain primacy. Consequently, there will be very, very few things more important than making sure that we get the right people around this table and come to a decision, a consensus decision about it. I could not put a point FTE, ascribe a point FTE personnel cost to this task force without knowing exactly how many times they're going to be meeting, et cetera. But we definitely intend to make whatever accommodation is necessary within current staffing to play a very key role in this task force.
Who's going to provide the, if you wish, the clerical staffing?
Mr. Chair, the department will.
The department will provide the clerical, et cetera, sort of staff.
That's correct. I think the amendment even says on line 17, the department shall provide staff support to the task force.
Okay.
Representative Kirk.
Yeah, but this is in your scope of work now. I mean, you're doing clean water whether this task force exists or not. I mean, so this really, I mean, and that's fine if we wait for an LFO opinion on this, but my opinion is that this is within scope of work and it's not going to cost you anything additional to do this.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, you're absolutely right in the sense of we don't expect any big outlays, frankly, of time or money, because if we don't do this, we might as well not come to work in the morning.
Well, and actually, without something like this, you might have to do more. So
it may be a revenue.
So can we take the money you're saving by creating a task force and fund the health plan? It's just a thought. Does that work for you? No, okay.
She don't want to fund the health plan.
Nobody wants to fund the health plan. I don't understand.
And Mr. Chair, you are correct. Vice Chair Dingfelder is absolutely correct. There is a Ways and Means referral to this under the original bill, and whether you rescind that and we deal with the expansion of the task force on the Senate side, or whether you keep that and we likely change this language in that joint committee, we're amenable to either option.
The chair is going to delay the vote on this until let me back up. Generally speaking, and this is not for the record, is the committee in agreement with where this bill's at and where it's going?
You mean two Ways and Means?
No. Are you in
agreement with it? Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'd say I'm in agreement with it. I find it amazing that so many times our compromises end up being study groups, but that's okay.
Yeah. Well, sometimes we get some good things.
Well, and I support this effort. I think it's appropriate, and I'm fully supportive of this plus the amendment that will be made somewhere.
Yeah. With that, I think we have, pretty much the assurance that the committee is going to act favorably on it, and it will take no additional time, as far as you all are concerned, appearing before the committee. But it is the wish of the chair to make the chief clerk happy and do it by the book. And as such, we will hold the work session, or the vote on this in the work session, until a subsequent work session, which the staff will schedule for next Tuesday. And by that time, we should have possibility of the fiscal, and should be able to have a little better idea which way we want to go with it.
Mr. Chair, I would also suggest this is a relatively simple amendment. We could do a dash 2 for that inclusion and send the Senate a clean, finished product.
Yes, yes. Yeah, that would also be the intention, to do a dash 2, and I would assume you will give Mr. Test a copy of the wording that you have.
Mr. Chair, you read my mind.
Thank you. Thank you very much, and we will then move this either way means or to the floor on Tuesday, following clarification of the issue and following the dash 2 amendment. And at that point, we got House Bill 2515. Whose bill is that? We'll close the work session on House Bill 2255 and open the work session on 2515. Representative Kurtz, you have interest in this bill?
As a matter of fact, Mr. Chair, I do.
Okay.
I have a very, very deep interest in this bill. You going to let Mr. Test do his thing first? Or?
Well, we're looking for the amendment here. I don't think we need to read what they think. The only thing we're looking for is any amendments we have.
There are no amendments, but there is a fiscal on this bill that you have a copy of in your handout, which would probably require that we move it. If we do move it to Ways and Means.
Right. Okay.
Okay.
I understood that there might be an amendment on this. Have we heard anything about that? Or what can
No. That's on a different.
Oh. Okay. Yeah. All right.
If I could just elucidate for a minute here. The reason for this bill is, as we continue to move forward with the Oregon Salmon Plan and trying to comply with clean water, one of the major roadblocks we continue to run into is the fact that out in the field, out where the actual projects are done, we don't have enough technical support to allow a lot of good projects to move forward in an expedited way. And we have a pot of money, thanks to Measure 66, that could help us in that direction. And I had this bill in last time. This has become, I think, even more important this year because of some federal funds that are going to become available through the Farm Bill for some various types of conservation activities that we may not be able to access simply because we don't have the support structure in place to utilize all those funds. And Mr. Chair, if I could, I would like to have John McDonald from OACD and Bob Graham from NRCS come up and kind of speak to that, if that would be okay with you.
That'd be fine. Please, Mr. McDonald. Good evening, or afternoon, as the case may be.
Depends on the time zone you're in.
Yeah. Well, we're right on that kind of swing hour here, so good evening.
Good evening.
Please, which one would like to?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I was asked to come down here and speak with you, not to speak in favor or in opposition to this bill, but rather to give you some information about the upcoming farm bill. By the way, I'm Bob Graham, state conservationist with the USDA's Natural Resource Conservation Service here in Oregon. I lead the agency as we have offices scattered throughout the state. I have a few remarks concerning the current farm bill's implementation in Oregon through our local, state, and federal partnership as it relates to House Bill 2515. And I'll discuss some of the funding coming to Oregon and the opportunity to leverage state funding with federal funding for technical assistance from Oregon Soil and Water Conservation District. As you know, we work through a locally led process to provide private landowners with voluntary financial and technical assistance to help take care of their land and water. I can't emphasize enough the critical role of Oregon's conservation districts and how they play in getting conservation on the land, not only in providing the guidance to us in how and where farm bill dollars should be invested — we do use a locally led process — but also in providing technical professionals trained and certified by our agency to assist landowners in meeting today's stringent environmental regulations. During the past federal fiscal year, we provided over $15 million in farm bill dollars through the Environmental Quality Incentives Program, the Wildlife Habitat Incentives Program, the Wetland Reserve Program, and the Ground and Surface Water Conservation Program. In these lean times, we're encouraged by the increased authorized and appropriated federal dollars anticipated to come here to Oregon. This is a ramp-up farm bill, and we are expecting increasing dollars each year. Although we have not yet received our allocation to verify this year's funds — as you know, the omnibus budget bill is a little late getting passed — that will actually verify the figures. We are anticipating approximately $25 million coming here to Oregon for those same programs that I mentioned above. Also, this next year, we're anticipating another increase based on the authorized levels that are in the farm bills. In addition to this, we have funding available through our Conservation Technical Assistance Program. We received approximately $8 million in that this last year, and we're expecting at least another $1 million this year. And, of course, the Farm Service Agency's Conservation Reserve Program and Conservation Enhancement Reserve Program. Are you amazed how I've avoided all the acronyms as we talk about the WIPs and the EQIPs and the CREPs and all those things? So I'm really trying hard to use all the words, which I'm not used to doing. In addition to that, and at some point if you want more information on this, I'll be glad to come and speak to you about it, but we have requested at our national level with the administration at the department that Oregon be allowed to participate, even if we're the only state that participates, in the new Farm and Ranch Land Protection Program. This is similar to the Conservation Reserve Program, only it's for grazing lands, Grazing Lands Reserve Program, and the Conservation Security Program, which is a new exciting program that could be much larger than most of the other programs put together. And these would provide significant dollars to our state. All of this money will continue to help landowners try to meet these environmental regulations that they're faced with and, of course, implement the Oregon Plan. But this opportunity comes at a price. The current bottleneck, as you have heard Representative Cruz mention, is the lack of technical assistance. This is what's holding up getting a lot of this conservation on the ground. an example with that. In the Klamath areas, we're working to try to come up with a reduced water demand. A lot of that involves conversion from flood to sprinkler. Now, that takes engineers to do the designing of the sprinkler system. It involves installation, it involves layout, and it involves irrigation water management for scheduling that irrigation over approximately a three-year period with that landowner. And this is all technical assistance to help them with the using the minimum amount of water for the crops that they're growing. There is a bright side to all of this, even though our concern right now is that we may not be able to use all these federal dollars coming to Oregon. We'll have to return them if we don't have the technical assistance to get them on the ground. The bright side is that the Congress recognized this. They've had numerous individuals testify on the behalf of technical assistance. But as you know, they're not interested in increasing federal employees. I can certainly sympathize with that. So the funding that they have provided has been in the form of technical assistance funds that we can use in a tool they are now calling contribution agreements. These are new. This will be the first year we will have these. It's an agreement where 50% of the federal dollars will go to an entity like conservation districts if they can come up with the other 50% to provide technical assistance for these farm bill programs. And as you know, the conservation districts at that local level leverage many programs, not just farm bill dollars, as they implement those. Depending on the amount of money available, and again, I don't know how much that is going to be until we receive our allocation, which should be in the next few weeks, it is my intent to sign agreements with the conservation districts if that funding is available to increase the amount of technical assistance that we have out there. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee members, for your time.
Thank you.
Mr. McDonald. Yes, Chair Jensen and members of the committee. I have a prepared testimony I could pass out, but I'll just talk off the top of my head because I think the issues are quite familiar to me. I've thought about them many times. As Mr. Graham has said...
For the record,
I'm sorry. John McDonald, Executive Director of the Oregon Association of Conservation Districts.
Thank you.
As Mr. Graham has said, as we talk a lot together, obviously, since the NRCS and the conservation districts work so closely together, both in legal ways and in rule ways and so forth, conservation districts are actually written into some of the manuals that to implement certain programs, the conservation district will do the following things. So we find ourselves integral and central to helping get these dollars into the right places on the right types of problems on the land. And that's obviously the concern. We also have the concern about just the basic staffing of what we're doing about state programs. Because if we take on the workload of trying to get the additional funding, which we need, that's going to go to solve the same problems we've identified from the federal sources, we're also going to have problems that are going to come up just because of some of our state rules. All of you are very familiar with SB 1010. Well, guess what? We're really close to having the plans written. Guess what else? We haven't thought about how we're going to do the implementation, because we don't have the resources to do the implementation without the technical assistance. That's what drives the implementation. We have the rules, we have the standards, and most of those standards are defining things that require the same kinds of skilled, competent, trained technical assistance, engineering, and so forth, that the Farm Bill programs that Mr. Graham was talking about require. We are also entering a new phase of another thing called AFL-CAFL. We used to deal with the large dairies, the large herds and so forth, the grazing herds and this type of thing. Now we're into many, many more landowners who are going to come under the rules who happen to have a few critters of some type or another. That's another workload. It's another additional thing where informing people, advising people, communicating with them, letting them know what the rules are all about, where they qualify or not, what they have to do to qualify, and then providing the technical assistance to do that. So we ourselves from the state and from responding to some of the federal initiatives of EPA and so forth and DEQ, looking at TMDLs and so forth, are seeing that there's an awful lot of demand on these landowners, and the number of landowners in the rural area that we have assignment for are not just the few major big producers anymore. There's a lot of other people out there that, sometimes euphemistically referred to as rural residentials or hobby farmers or something, that, believe it or not, they're even less capable and have less equipment, for example, to make the changes on the landscape that maybe a large producer would have. So, again, with the higher demand of the bills and the rules and the requirements, the higher demand of the number of landowners that need help, and the higher resource that's going to help us through the Farm Bill programs, and a lot of those programs also apply to some of these smaller landowners as well, it just makes sense to say that if the key to linking those two things together happens to be the available technical assistance you can get when you go to the knock on the door of the office, it makes sense to try to leverage those federal dollars and also meet the higher landowner demand. There's a lot of other reasons why, of course, you know, some stable funding would be wise. We have a high turnover. We are the best doggone farm team going for other natural resource agencies. We've trained so many people who now work for DEQ and city water systems and stuff like that, because we ourselves, there's such an uncertainty about the funding, and, you know, well, I've only got 70% coming to me, and I got to scrape for the other 30%, and they find it easier to go someplace else. Now, we love the idea that we've got good trained people. We've sent them forward to do other things, like become representatives from place in Portland or something like that. But
I have no idea who you're talking about.
Why talk about getting set up?
And I'm not sure, John, you've trained her fully yet. But
we have a booster shots wasn't I had in mind, but maybe some CPE stuff would work out. So yeah. Anyway, obviously the need is there. Everybody's identified it. It's just a matter of can we come up with the funds to help support it and leverage the other dollars. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions for?
Well, Mr. Chair, I've known these gentlemen for a long, long time, and we're talking about an integral part of our natural resource system here, and I think they spoke to it. It's not just the Oregon Salmon Plan. It's the Clean Water Act. It's 10-10. There's just a whole lot of things going in, and about every other year, the feds throw another something at us, which they did 2 years ago with AFO, that really caught us kind of unaware. Because we had been operating CAFO and STAFE over 20 years very successfully, and then they decided to change the parameters. So, I guess I've talked to the folks on the Ways and Means Sub. They're interested in this concept. I think we ought to give them as a tool when they're making their funding decisions. But you know, not only is the need great and the possibility of losing federal funds also great, simply because we can't do the work, but the feds have thrown a new kicker into this, and that's the fact that we can hire people and get match, and that's first time we've ever had something like that. I mean, this is, I do human services. That's where I make most of my living in this building, and we chase federal dollars all the time. And because, quite simply, to spend 50 cents and get a dollar's worth of product makes a lot of sense when we're in a tight budget situation. And that's exactly what we have the opportunity to do here. And, I'm not sure specifically that what they do in Ways and Means will be exactly as I've envisioned this, but I think sending this bill to Ways and Means gives them that opportunity.
Mr. Chair, may I ask Representative Joplin, Representative Cruz, what you just said, if we do this and get that federal matching money, can we put that back into OEB, or is that against the law?
Mr. Chair, what we would do is if we put the money out to fund half of a position, the feds will match it and fund the other half of the position. So the savings to us is half of the cost of that position. So for the same amount of dollars, we could fund twice as many positions. Or fund the same number of positions we are going to fund and have that much more money left over to spend in other things.
Chair.
Representative Inko.
I just wanted to... We're in work session now, right?
We are.
I just wanted to respond and maybe ask a question of the panel, and I'm sure John McDonald's going to ask where he went wrong. But I just wanted to say for the record that I absolutely agree that there needs to be more technical assistance. From my own personal experience, that's what I found, whether it's in agriculture, forestry, and many other areas. And I served on the Healthy Streams Partnership for 2 years. We came out with a report that said we need to find some more funding for technical assistance. And I don't have an issue with that whatsoever. What I do have an issue with in this bill is how we're going to find that source of funding. And I have been looking at the numbers, you know, and trying to figure out, I mean, I don't see the pie growing any bigger, so the money's got to come from somewhere. And the concern that I do have is taking money away from other projects that we're trying to fund on the ground through the watershed councils, which are doing, you know, parallel, just as good work as SWCDs. So I don't know if you could address that, and maybe, I don't know if OWEB, if we could ask OWEB to come up and maybe address. I see that there's somebody here from OWEB. So I'd like to know if that money, if I'm reading this right, the money's going to be coming from OWEB, so I want to know what's the opportunity cost of using this money if we're not funding the programs at OWEB. I don't know if you can answer that, John, or if we can get somebody from OWEB to come up.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, I don't know all the ins and outs of what all the funds are and stuff like that, and I don't want to say, you know, take it from this fund, take it from that fund, you know, to cut somebody else's funding to add to our funding and so forth. That's a decision that, unfortunately, we hired you all for. And
unfortunately?
Did I misspeak, Chair?
You're treading on thin ice there, John.
I'm sure, Jensen, I've got a big shovel, too, and I'm digging as fast as I can. I strike oil, I'll share it with you, okay? Fortunately, we have your wise counsel to figure out how to do that. I think what we're saying is, here's an opportunity. The need is there. We've all defined the need. The resources are scarce. The need other places is equally, you know, of merit. It's all over the place. And I'm not going to talk about another program. I'm not going to talk against another program. I'm not saying steal from another program. I'm just saying we need it. But we don't get it. We keep looking for it, but we need it.
Thank you.
I think you made your case well. Thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate it. I would like to get the hands.
Okay.
Chair's calling Ken Bailey from Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. You've heard the discussions that we've had so far, and I think originally there was about a 4.9 million fiscal on this bill, plus or minus some change. And if we got a 50% match, we're down to, let me round it off at 2.5 million, sort of thing on the bill that would exist.
I think if I heard correctly, for the record, Ken Bearley, Deputy Director of the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. The bill, as it currently states, is to put a position, full-time position, in each county in the state, and which, if you make certain assumptions about that pay level, it's about $4.9 million. The testimony I heard was that because of the Farm Bill program, they can leverage that to 2-to-1, something of that magnitude. And I think that's significant. I think one of the things that is very important here is that, unfortunately, we are playing a zero-sum game. The current budget, the governor's balanced budget, has allocated the entire amount of ballot measure 66 funds, the lottery operations funds. In fact, just this morning, the co-chairs of the Ways and Means put together the natural resource allocation fund that zeroed out ballot measure 66 funds for both watershed councils and soil and water conservation districts and shifted those to federal funds. So we currently, and in the past two biennia, have put $2.4 million into soil and water conservation districts through the Department of Agriculture at their discretion how they use those funds to support soil and water conservation districts. So there is funding for districts, and it's at parity with funding for watershed councils. What this bill would do is shift that parity. Because it is a zero-sum game, the money would have to come from somewhere else. The Joint Ways and Means have identified, again, have zeroed out the, there is no flex in the Measure 66 operations, which is 35% of the Measure 66 funds that could fund these positions. It would have to come from some of the allocations that have been identified in the co-chair's allocations. So what this bill would do is specify at least an allocation level that would go to districts. And there is no question on anyone's part that technical assistance is a critical need in local communities. No one contests that. The merit of the concept is great. The distributive effects of this bill, I think, are what is at issue. The Ways and Means, we're responding to the Ways and Means Committee who's trying to allocate the funds. What we see is that they've been allocated as of this morning's memo from Senator Schrader and Representative Miller.
I've never seen a budget appear at this time of the year, but the time of the session that didn't go through some significant changes, but I may be surprised this session. That aside, it strikes me that the effort we're trying to make to deal with our environmental issues and concerns is one where perhaps if I can use the analogy again for the second time in a few days, a Fram oil filter ad, pay me now or pay me later. If we fail to get the technical expertise, not only do we fail to get probably the federal match money that might be there, but in addition to that, since that is one of the major obstacles, as I have seen it and heard it, and as you testified in front of committees that I've been on before, the technical people on the ground are the real big reason that we can't move some of the things along, that we can't expect the local folks to necessarily have that kind of technical expertise, especially when we get into some of the complexities that we're dealing with.
Absolutely, I have no difference in that.
Yeah.
We have received federal funds for which we've designated and distributed in excess of $1 million just in the last 6 months for technical assistance, and it's been balanced between councils and districts. So we are trying to find resources for that specific purpose. We think that it's a critical need. It's one we will continue to try to find resources for.
Okay. Representative Cruz, you had some additional
it's interesting. Supporting the concept, but the funding decision isn't made here. And I guess somebody told me that you guys had pretty much identified, you've got to kind of narrow down to 15 watersheds in the state, big picture. Is that true?
No.
Okay, then obviously Jeff Huntington doesn't know what he's talking about. Okay, that's enough for now.
Representative Cruz, what you may have been listening to is how we are reporting on sub-basin approaches. If you look at the Oregon Plan Biennial Report, there are 15 basins, which is Common Spatial Geography, Third Field Hydrologic Unit, in which we report accomplishments. But those are independent basins. They are biologically and hydrologically meaningful, but they're not always socially meaningful.
But wasn't the whole purpose of the Oregon plan to do ridgetop to ridgetop, basin by basin, and you have 15. So I guess I'm trying to figure out how we got turned from the direction we started out in 95. So, but Mr. Chair, this...
I think that the issue here is a substantive policy discussion about how we allocate resources to support local communities, and I think there's a legitimate policy discussion about how we distribute those resources, and I think that's the nub of the policy question here, and whether we have 45 districts, four of which are in Baker County, or we have 57 watershed councils, or how we divide that, I think is an important discussion, and I think that this bill is an element of that discussion, but I think that it is a preemptive effort to deal with that discussion.
Well, I guess just to follow up, Mr. Chair, I mean, you said just a little while ago that you were looking for any way you could to supplement tech support, and here we've got a match program. I mean, you know, that seems fairly obvious to me that this is a good direction to go.
And we're currently investing in excess of $3 million into that match opportunity. And the question is, given competing demands, how do we allocate those resources?
You're right. That's the question.
Yep.
Anything else? Anybody else? We're going to close the session on we got House Bill 2515 for now. We'll be back revisiting it. This will go on the schedule for Tuesday. Okay. We are therefore at. I see Representative March here, and I believe he's here to talk to us about this bill 2519. Or 2991, excuse me. I would like to know about this bill, and I am opening a work session. I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 2991.
Mr. Chair, allows owner of water right or farmland that would be subject to capital gain taxation from qualified sale to elect not to recognize capital gain of taxpayer purchases capital asset of similar class and similar characteristic within 1 year, or if taxpayer applies amount of capital gain to long-term farm debt within 1 year. Applies to tax years beginning on or after January 1, 2004. It has a legislative fiscal for minimal expenditure impact, which would mean that generally it would not be referred to Ways and Means. It's under the low. And it has a prior referral to House Revenue on this bill. And so I assume that with that information, you'll make your decision. Thank you.
Mr. Test, we will proceed with Representative March's explanation of this bill as he perceives it and his motivations, I suppose, for moving it forward or looking to move it forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. And members of the committee, for the record, my name is Steve March. I represent House District 46 in the center of Portland. This bill grew out of the frustrations that Representative Garrard and I were having at the end of the 2001 session. As you recall, the Klamath Basin in particular was hard hit by a drought, and they were going down with the bucket brigade, but obviously that wasn't bringing much water, and some folks had to sell their water rights or even sell their farms. Under current tax law, that would require them either to reinvest within 90 days, basically, to identify property to reinvest within 90 days, performing what's called an IRS Section 1031 Starker exchange. It has to be completed within a relatively short period of time. And if you've ever looked for a house, you know it's difficult to find something within 90 days, and it's even harder to find adequate farmland within that period of time. So this bill was actually drafted at the end of 2001, but we ran out of time to get it introduced. And what it would allow is if a farmer is in a drought area, and that's has to be declared a drought area, and they wind up selling their water rights or their property, under Oregon law, they would have a year in which to reinvest or to pay off capital debt. That basically gives them a little bit of cushion for those people who are caught in those drought situations. What I don't anticipate this being as an incentive for anyone, because the federal regulations still would require them to pay capital gains if they don't invest within the 90-day window. So this is only for those people who are really caught in the middle of a bad situation and are hard hit. My thinking there was, if somebody's in a bad enough situation where they have to sell, let's give them a little break, let them reinvest within a year, and then they don't have to pay capital gains. And with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Representative. Question?
It sounds like a very interesting bill, Representative, but I'm somewhat confused. If they have to sell their water right or the property, I would assume just for living expenses, how would they be able to reinvest that money in...
Usually it's not just for living expenses. They may be caught in a situation where they have a debt payment coming due, or they just don't have enough cash flow to make it. However, that's why I put the provision in there about paying off their long-term debt. So maybe, say for example, I have 150 acres in the Klamath Basin, and we're in a drought, if it's declared a drought area, and I find, well, you know, I've got 150 acres here, I really I'm going to sell 50 acres of water rights. Normally that would be considered a capital gain. And instead, this bill would allow, under Oregon tax code, a farmer to take and put that 50, whatever he got for those water rights on the 50 acres, against his long-term debt on the farm, thus preserving the farm intact, even though he had to give up some water rights to do it. In a different case, if they wound up having to sell the whole property, they could go and reinvest in another farm property. It could be a smaller property, but as long as they reinvested the amount that would normally be considered capital gain, that would be covered, and that would take care of the capital gains for Oregon.
Follow-up. Yes. So this is similar to the capital gains that one can get on selling a house. So you could
it would bring it more in line to that. But homes are treated differently than farm property or any kind of business property. Homes, as you know, I think it's up to $300,000 now. You can basically pocket without having to pay capital gains. It used to be that you had to reinvest within 2 years for homes. That was changed, federal law changed. This doesn't do anything about that, but farm property is treated like a business property, and so there's a different tax rule on that. But it would make it similar to that, only they'd still have to reinvest. Yeah, the concepts are...
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Any other questions? They let you off the hook easily.
Well, thank you. And yeah,
actually, Representative March, I have one question. Seeing that the Klamath straddles California and Oregon, do you have any idea if California has done anything similar?
I don't know. I could find out, though. It might be worth researching. And some of our farmers actually do have properties in both states. But I want to make sure that the reinvestment was in Oregon property rather than in California property.
Okay, thank you.
I do have one question.
Okay.
I'm just glad to see Portland representatives down here helping farmers. Let me just say that. Thank you, Representative Mark.
You grew up driving a tractor, isn't that right?
Well, I grew up on a farm, and so that's kind of the background of that. And after spending a lot of time with Representative Girard last session and listening to the plight of the farmers down there, I was just trying to think, okay, what can we do from here? I mean, we can't send them water, if we don't, you know, but maybe we can take care of some tax problems.
California, we would be. Representative Flores.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative March, just so that I'm clear, this pertains to the Oregon capital gains, and I think you said that the IRS 1031 Starker exchange provisions would still then apply to these people. So they're still going to have a responsibility within that short term, only the federal.
Right. If they were able to accomplish the federal rules, the 1031 Starker exchange under federal rules within the 90-day identification period, they wouldn't owe federal taxes or Oregon taxes. But if they weren't able to accomplish that, they would still owe federal money, but not Oregon taxes. Okay. So it only affects the Oregon tax portion.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
Stick around. There might be some questions from the chair. Glenn Stonebring from the Oregon County.
Good evening, Glenn.
Good evening, sir, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Glenn Stonebrink. I'm with the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. Thank you for staying late and hearing these bills. The Oregon Cattlemen's Association generally support this bill, but we do have some concerns that we want to get on record. That basically, we don't believe that people should be selling water rights. It should not be actually even legal to sell water rights. However, we do understand the situation, especially with the Klamath farmers and some other farmers, that when they have their water rights stolen by government or by the courts, you know, what are they to do? So we support that. A couple questions on the statement or small D. It starts on line 14. Our concern is, why would this only qualify if that farmer sells their water rights or land to government or to a nonprofit organization, excuse me, for conservation purposes? And it says, or for other public purposes, and I kind of question mark by that. I don't know what the other public purposes are. But the bottom line, as this bill is written, that land is out of production, basically. Now, I understand that the I doubt if the state government is going to be going to afford to purchase these lands. Federal government might purchase them if they see there's some benefit as far as conservation or a bird habitat or something of that nature. But what we're looking at here is, in a sense, and yet I still want to help these farmers, but in a sense we're saying, let's encourage people to take land out of production. And that's what I guess that's where we're headed in most everything that's happened today, and as far as agriculture anyway. So just throw this on top of the heap. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Glenn. Any questions for Mr. Stonebring?
Mr. Chair, I do have a
Representative Shoffer.
So you believe that the water rights should just stay with the land all the time. And I'm not saying that's wrong. I'm just asking you to clarify that.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's true, because our basic belief is that when someone, oftentimes not the farmer who owns the water right now, but maybe their great-grandfather or someone they bought the ranch or farm from years ago, what they did when they obtained the water rights, and they went to the state and they said, I want to use the water. I don't want to use the water for a particular beneficial purpose in this case, and in most cases way back then it was irrigation, for a specific purpose on the land. Now, they didn't buy the water or the water right when they obtained it. They got permission to use the water. And the trend we have today is that there are organizations, and we have this so-called in-stream rights, that if they can purchase the senior water right holder's water, even if they're not using all of it, that that goes back into stream. It leaves the land. It leaves the land forever. That the when they made a contract and asked for permission to use the water, they didn't say, oh, and by the way, I'm going to sell it. That was never the intent. And when they applied for it, and the only difference between then and today is time. There's really nothing that has changed in that. And so a water right holder, an irrigator, can give up their water rights. That could then the state could reallocate those as the needs arise. If they see it's if there's other people out there that have applied for water rights, the permit holder or the water right holder could, if they don't use their water in 5 years, they could lose their water rights. And again, it's then given back to the state, but not for in-stream purposes, which locks it up forever from the land. That's our belief.
Mr. Chair, if I may, just comment. If I would rather, if someone has a water right on some marginal land that was never really going to be productive, and they just wanted to raise some llamas on it or cattle or whatever they could with the water that fell from the sky, I would personally, in my opinion, maybe I'm wrong on this, I'd rather them sell their water right to some farmer or rancher that did have productive property. Especially in a case where someone with productive soil, who in these drought times really needs some water really bad, I just see it that way, and maybe I'm wrong. But I just wanted to comment on that. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I agree with you that if this bill said you could sell your water right to another farmer, but maybe you recover within a year or whatever and you buy either those water rights back from that farmer or you buy them from some other farmer, in the meantime, you don't have to pay capital gains. Because I had a question from my office. They said, how do you figure capital gains on water right? Well, you paid zero for it. So I assume anything that you could get would be total. You pay capital gains on the whole thing. I don't know how any other way to calculate that. And if we could keep that, whether it be land or water, that the individual would be paying, or would sell their, in a drought situation, they qualify under everything else of the provision. If they could sell it to another farmer, why not? And still have the one-year capital gains exemption. I agree.
Thank you, Adam, for the record, please.
Yeah, Adam Sussman with the Water Resources Department, Mr. Chair.
Appreciate your being here from the Water Resources. I would like to question you about the legality and the legal complications of selling your water rights. Of selling a water right, not necessarily selling the land.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think if you recall, I came and talked to the committee several weeks ago about this whole topic of water marketing, moving water around, either for economic development purposes or environmental restoration purposes. And there's nothing that I'm aware of in statute that prohibits someone from moving, you know, a water right from one place to another. In fact, of course, we have all kinds of water code provisions that allow the transfer of a water right both in stream to different types of uses and to different places of use. And I have to say that outside of the state's purview, the transactions that go on between a water right holder and someone who wants a water right are transactions that occur in the private sector outside of the jurisdiction of the state. And again, there's nothing in the statute that prohibits that kind of transaction.
Okay. Mr. Chair, may I please? I know it's getting late, but may I ask a question of one of the chief sponsors, Representative March?
We're not in work session, but if he's willing to come back up to the thing to, I'd be happy to let you indulge you with that.
Thank you.
Don't run away.
Thank you, Representative March.
I'm for the record, Steve March.
Can I ask you why we don't have farmers and ranchers in among the people that these rights could be sold to?
I just had to look at the bill again myself. I think when we originally drafted it, the discussion was circulating around the issue of the state or environmental groups or some other governmental entity, the county, buying up those water rights. And it certainly, I think, would be within the purview of this committee to add that. And I'm not, I'm not opposed to that. The one problem that we might run into is the fiscal might start creeping up, but because you're going to be foregoing some capital gains. But on the other hand, I certainly see the potential wisdom in that, and was thinking of that in the back of my mind. But as I recall now, I realize the bill was drafted in that narrow context of where we thought, oh, somebody's going to be forced to sell their water rights, in particular to conservation district or something like that, and so that's why the bill was narrowly crafted.
Thank you.
Colleagues, I'm going to close, unless you have any other comments, the public hearing on House Bill 2991. I think Representative March has given us something to think about. We'll plan accordingly, if everything works out, to look at this bill on Thursday, if we hear it again, a week from Thursday.
Thank you.
At this time, we're going to open the public hearing on House Bill 3309. Municipalities, partial perfect and loss of priority or cancellation of permit. See Mr. Tiffany here to explain to us why the cities want this. This bill has a physical with it.
And physical, maybe.
Physical. Okay. Go ahead, Mr. Tiffany.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, again, I'm Willie Tiffany with the League of Oregon Cities, and I want to thank you, Mr. Chair, for sponsoring House Bill 3309. The bill simply changes the partial perfection statutes from the minimum level in current law of 25% of a permit to 5%. And if I could, Mr. Chair, I'd like to kind of give you some background on a couple of issues as to why municipalities are at this point where we're supporting this bill and would like to see this change. As you know, municipalities are unique in terms of water users. They have very unique needs. Our peak demands and our regular demands shift very widely compared to other water users. We accommodate a broad range of water uses, all the way from irrigation to industrial to drinking water sources to even aesthetic uses are all incorporated in the definition of a municipal use. And importantly for this bill, we're also required to do long-range water planning. We do not have a choice in terms of water supply for our communities. We must plan and provide water, potable drinking water, for the communities that we serve.
In order to meet all these needs, unlike other water users, typically municipal water suppliers plan their supplies over very long periods of time. And so in the permit process, they obtain permits with very long development time periods and develop them slowly as their community needs grow. In fact, Oregon used to have a provision in law with regard to the extension process that required municipal extensions every 5 years. And so the incentive for municipal water users at that time was to continually ask for 5-year extensions while they're working towards total perfection of their permit. And the point here is that in the past, municipalities really had no incentive to perfect water as they went along, but instead the incentive was to develop an entire permit over a very, very long period of time instead of perfect as they went through the process. However, in the last year, well, actually over the last 5 years, the world of municipal permit extensions has changed dramatically. In fact, the Water Resources Commission last fall just adopted new Division 315 rules with respect to municipalities only, and they adopted, which are permit extension rules.
Well, in relationship to those rule adoptions, was there a work group that task force been meeting on that for some 2 or 4 years or something?
Actually, 5 years, Mr. Chair. This
5 years.
The question arose in 1997 when the Attorney General issued an opinion which brought into doubt for all water users water permit extensions. There was a work group that worked on all other permit holders other than municipalities, as water users recognized the unique needs of municipalities would be different than those of other water users. And there was a specific work group put together called the Community Water Supply Work Group that met over 5 years, came up with a proposal that was approved by the Water Resources Commission last fall. Now, what that proposal did, the structure, I won't go into the details of all the rule amendments, but the structure of the rule basically did two things. It said for municipalities, you can now obtain an extension for a very long period of time, however much time you need to develop that permit. However, you can't use that water. You can't develop it until you file a Division 86 Water Management and Conservation Plan. Once a municipality files one of those plans where they have to look at their growth demand, they have to look at conservation measures, management measures, curtailment measures, and they have to plan in a very short time frame the immediate amount of water that they're going to use. And they have to update that plan every 5 years, have to check in with the department. So what we've done is we've taken a real open process in terms of how municipalities develop permits and put into place an intensive planning process, more similar to the land use type of process, for development of those water permits. So municipalities, although under the permit extension, may obtain very long periods of time for extension of development of water, they can only actually develop the water they can prove they need in a very short amount of time. So that got municipal water suppliers thinking about the partial perfection statutes, and that's how we got there. The partial perfection statute was passed in 1989, hasn't been used very often. It was basically designed to accommodate transfers of PODs and other transfer type issues. It was never meant to be a tool used with the extension process. And what we have today is an opportunity to kind of marry both the partial perfection process and the extension process by lowering that percentage. If I could provide an example to just out of the air, City A may have a permit for 50 CFS. It may take them, they may file an extension, it may take them 70 years to fully grow in, 50 years, you know, a long period of time to grow into that permit. However, in the next 5 years, they may only use 2, 3, 4, 5 CFS to meet their short-term needs. What this bill would allow them to do is perfect those needs as they develop them through the process, instead of waiting, as we had in the past, until the full development period has been achieved.
It strikes me that with this intensive planning process that you outlined, that the cities must have made out like bandits here as far as their budgets are concerned somewhere along the way. Could you explain to me where that money came from? And Representative Tomei might be interested in running for mayor again if he found out what the, you know, where all that money came from.
It looks better every day.
Mr. Chair, in answer to that question, we're certainly not flush in cash. However, this is an extensive and expensive process.
Right.
It will have a fiscal impact.
The point I'm getting to is this is a very expensive process.
I guess just in summary, Mr. Chair, we see this as a tool again to marry the partial perfection process with a planned development of water rights. This bill will not, I just want to make it clear, will not impact the amount of water that cities are allowed under their permits. It will not impact other consumptive users. It will not impact in-stream water rights. And I guess in closing, Mr. Chair, I think Mr. Sussman will be up here to testify. The department does have some amendments to address the fiscal concerns the department would have with partial perfections, and we think their amendments are fair, and we would support those to allow them to charge a fee if a municipality would like to use this tool. With that, Mr. Chair, we hope you'd support the bill and be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Sussman, please. Hang on a little in case I have questions for you. Carolyn,
good evening again, and for the record, Adam Sussman with the Water Resources Department. And thank you for the opportunity to present testimony on House Bill 3309. I did want to just start off by reiterating what Mr. Tiffany said, that the bill as printed would have a fiscal impact not anticipated in the governor's balanced budget, and therefore we can't support the bill without addressing that fiscal impact. The Dash 1 amendments that I hope you have in front of you are our idea for addressing that general fund fiscal impact, which is to charge a fee for a partial perfection. Right now, in statute, there is no fee at all for a partial perfection. So that's the gist of the amendment in front of you. I believe Mr. Tiffany's given you a pretty good background of the process that we went through for several years to work with many different stakeholders to come to terms with how we deal with municipal water right permits and their extension. And I just want to take a step back and make sure that everybody understands sort of the distinction between a permit and a certificate, because it is pretty important. A permit is really an authorization to use water, whereas a certificate is what is issued once you perfect, and you keep hearing that word perfect, basically you provide evidence that you've developed that authorization, and you are issued a water right certificate, which is a confirmation of the use and is actually a water right at that point. And the distinction is pretty important. So when you're thinking about partial perfection, keep that distinction in mind. Again, Mr. Tiffany recognized that really the legislature made some public policy decisions back in 1989 to provide this sort of partial perfection provision for municipalities. And this is just one of many provisions and statutes that really recognize the unique nature of municipal water rights. They are very different than other water rights in that they need to be developed over a long period of time. In terms of this bill, the issuance of a water right certificate for municipal use really provides a number of benefits that I think you may have heard already. It really, again, provides a confirmed water right as compared to an authorization. It provides an opportunity to perfect over the long-term horizon, sort of commensurate with the development of a municipal right. And it provides greater certainty in terms of the status of that water right, because if you have to wait 60 years or 40 years to develop your water right, you'll be sort of carrying it in a permit status all that time. So it provides some certainty in terms of that status, which may be an important element in terms of financing system improvements or even making conservation improvements. So again, at least the department's view of House Bill 3309 is that it simply increases the opportunity to take advantage of a statute, a provision in law that already exists. Thank you.
One question. We got this 25% or 20, yeah. May partially perfect not less than 25% of the water authorization. What's the time element on that? Am I missing something here?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, I don't
What's
understand.
What's the time element on this?
How long do you have to perfect? Is that what you're...
Yeah.
How long do you have to perfect the water right?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, typically the way the water law works is when you're issued a permit, you have an initial five-year development period. Thereafter, if you have not developed the right within 5 years, which is pretty typical for a municipal water provider, you need to ask for an extension of time. And as Mr. Tiffany described, under the new rules, the new structure, that extension of time could be 10 years, 20 years, 60 years. It just depends on your individual circumstances. So it's really the perfection, the 25% any time within that period.
But there's no time frame or that the city loses its water, right?
No, Mr. Chair, there's no time frame.
Time immemorial?
Well, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, again, in order to develop your permit, you need to request an extension. You know, if you get to the point where your extension has...
If I'm Joe Blow out here with an irrigation right, I lose if I don't after so long. If I haven't got the certificate, is that right?
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the holder of an irrigation right can, in a similar fashion, request a extension of time to develop the water right.
There's a limited number of extensions?
No, Mr. Chair.
No, a limited number of extensions? Okay.
Mr. Chair, I think the standard in law is that the department needs to find good cause in order to approve the extension. So as we go through the process and we go through the statutory criteria, there needs to be good cause.
Mr. Chair, just to add on to that, in the new rules, there are provisions that require additional standards and provisions for permits, additional extension or approval of your Division 86 plan, as well as new extensions, which require greater test or determination of good cause.
Okay. Other questions? Mr. Doug Myers from Water Watch, please. Don't run away. No, you can, just... Good evening, Doug. Thanks for bearing with us here for a little while.
Welcome, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. It's not exactly a pleasure to be here testifying against this bill, with the chair being the chief sponsor and three members of the committee also being sponsors, but here goes.
We've talked previously tonight about the shovels to dig your way out.
Thank you.
I think at this point we probably have a spare or two around, and in case you need it, just whistle.
My written testimony will lead you to believe that I am Kimberly Priestley, but I am not. I'm here delivering your testimony for her, and I just want to just very briefly go through and get right into the heart of it at the bottom of the first page. Just tell you that municipal water rights are indeed a very different thing than Joe Blow irrigator, and that causes some resentment in the agricultural community, I can tell you. I didn't really hear a very good reason for lowering this unique 25% partial perfection to 5%. So, first of all, the second point is, what is the reason for this? And I don't really understand why. And the first reason would be the fairness issue.
why should municipalities already have a lot of flexibility to partially perfect 25% of their water right? No other water right holder, whether an irrigation district, a farmer, an industrial user, or a miner, enjoys this ability to partially perfect just the municipalities. And third, this allows the municipality to perfect as you go in 5% increments, and we think that that bar is way too low, and we are concerned. So with that, we are opposed to the bill as written. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Tolman.
Thank you. What harm is there in granting this?
During the 5 years, Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, during the 5 years, I was not a regular member of this work group, but a lot of us people put a lot of time and effort into it, and there wasn't a real agreement at the end of the work group, I can tell you. The reason is that a lot of municipalities have water rights that they can never use. And if they're allowed to partially perfect as they go along, we're concerned, the municipality should be allowed to have as much water as it can with land use laws and everything else, projections as to population. That's fine, and we agree with that. What we don't agree is municipalities tying up large amounts of water literally forever.
Other questions? I don't have any. I have some concerns that about the difference between the other users and municipalities. However, I'm not real sure, Mr. Meyer, that I agree with the testimony in terms of the unfairness of this. In fact. In my district or my area, there are for economic development, there's sometimes a necessity to be able to sign 99-year lease or something of that nature, long-term leases with companies, and if we don't have the ability to have very large water rights. That there's no reason to ask the taxpayers to perfect it all at one time. There's no demand for it, but as new industry comes in, you're not going to be able to keep and continue to attract new industry into the area if you have some if there appears to be some problem as far as the ability to get water somewhere down the line in the future. If there's not some sort of guarantee, some sort of assurance that basic need that the industry or industries will have, can look forward to having water in the future. And while I personally have some difference or some concern about the difference between municipalities and irrigators. I do recognize that there is a distinct difference between a municipality and an irrigator or a farmer, a rancher, or a dairy, or whatever it happens to be. A municipality has a life forever, short of some natural holocaust or something like that, and there needs to be some ability, it seems to me, to be able to look forward and plan, if you wish, for the future.
Mr. Chair, we recognize that. And I've often thought that it would be really good if everybody could sit down at some point and discuss Western water law, including the premise that use it or lose it. And all the rest of it, and the differences between municipalities and the unique problems they have versus farmers or industry, or indeed values for fish and recreation and pollution abatement and all the rest of it. But that doesn't seem to be possible.
I think there are a number of us who would welcome the
legal mind and the perhaps very mentally ill mind that would undertake, you know, the rewriting of Western water law. Ours is, I've heard some say that it's worse than others or the worst of all. I don't believe that's the case. The couple of states that I am familiar with, Western states that I'm familiar with, is a terrible gibberish, and we keep fumbling along and making it more complicated every time one of these bodies meets and passes another bill about water law.
My point exactly with this bill, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, and the chair appreciates that. And the committee, I think, by now has come to appreciate that, too. Are there other questions?
I promised my last question.
That's all right. You don't have to promise things, you know.
Doug, you mentioned in your last paragraph that it could result in less water in our rivers and streams. Could you tell us about that?
Just looking for my notes on this. Once you certificate something, the ability of the state Water Resources Department to regulate transfers and things goes away. If a municipality under present law, unique present law, comes in and perfects in 25% increments at a time, they have to go through an extension process, which is really a good process because it allows all sorts of water right groups with interests, not just water rights, but others, to comment on it and to show just cause and that they really need the water, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You can perfect in 5% increments. It builds up and becomes unassailable. So we do like the review process as the extension rules and law now provide for.
I'm sorry, it wasn't my last question. I'm still having trouble, if I may.
You may, Representative.
I'm still having trouble visualizing that because it seems to me that already they've got this water right promised to them, a certain amount of cubic feet per second, right?
Mr. Chair,
I guess let me finish my question.
Okay.
So if they don't use it, if they're not using it now, but it's promised to them, and the water is still in the river or wherever it is until they decide to use it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, this is what really got everything going was this Attorney General's opinion, which said that, yes, a municipality can indeed lose a permit, part of their permit, if they don't use it. And now the municipalities say, we don't agree with that AG's opinion, but it is the AG's opinion, and state agencies have to follow that AG's opinion. And Water Watch agrees with the AG's opinion that a municipal permit, given with, you know, without the extensive review of a certification process, can be huge, and they can never use it. Now, a municipality will tell you, you can't ever cancel any portion of that. We disagree. So they don't have a big block of water that's a permit assigned to them forever. They don't have it.
Thank you.
We're going to, at this point, then close the public hearing on House Bill 3309 and open a work session on House Bill 3309. Is there discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dingler.
Thank you. I'm not going to be very articulate because I'm awfully tired. But I have to say that I still have questions about this, and you'll notice I'm the one committee person who didn't sign on to, or one of the few that didn't sign on, because I did have questions, and I guess I still have some concerns about if this is absolutely needed. And the one thing I think it's raised a concern for me is the fiscal impact and how that would be addressed, considering we still have a huge backlog of transfers for the Water Resources Department, and this would create even more work. So I'll be a no, a soft no, if that's possible, but I will be a no on this bill.
It guarantees that you won't have to carry a duct tape.
Not nothing. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Are there other?
Could I just ask a question? I thought that the amendment took care of the extra cost. Isn't that true?
Yes. The amendment says. The amendment goes to the extra. The extra.
It goes to Ways and Means. I think they have to.
It does go to Ways and Means. However, there will be no fiscal, I think. It goes to Ways and Means by a prior reference. But with the amendment, there should be no drain on state resources.
Thank you for that clarification.
Is that correct?
Yeah. I'm so tired, I didn't even read all of it.
We have to recommend it to Ways and Means.
We would have to?
Yes. We have
it's not.
We have a fiscal statement, which means it has to go there, so it's up to us, and then we ask the.
Yeah. Okay. Would the we call the roll then?
Well, I want me to move dash one amendments.
Yeah, if you would.
I move
Representative Tomei moves the dash one amendments to House Bill 3309. I'm getting rummy too. Without seeing no objections, or we take another motion.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3309 as amended to the floor with due pass recommendation with subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Thank you, Representative. We have a motion on the floor. The reason for the subsequent referral to Ways and Means is that the original bill has a fiscal, even though we don't have a reference given us that it came down to us. So, any other questions?
Mr. Chair,
I apologize. I was out working on the health plan. I'm just.
Thank you for protecting.
You're in bad. You're in a lot of trouble, Representative. But actually, because you're a legislator and we make no money, you're probably qualified. I was just confused. I'm not quite sure what a soft no is. So I just came in.
When Representative Tomei votes no, you'll be able to tell when it's a hard no versus a soft.
It means that I'll probably be discussing this before it gets to the floor for a vote. But I'm voting no in committee for now until I get some of my answers, my concerns answered.
Call the roll, please.
Representative Cruz.
Aye.
Representative Shaw.
Aye.
Representative Tomei.
Aye.
Representative
Dinkfeller.
No. Representative
Crowley. Excuse.
Aye.
Having received the majority vote, House Bill 3309 as amended is referred to Ways and Means. And we're going to skip over, you may, if you wish, Representative. We're going to skip over because Ms. Brown has been patiently waiting to testify on House Bill 2306 and going to hear her testimony on House Bill 2306. Following the testimony, her testimony on 2306, and I need to keep a quorum here to do this.
Mr. Chair, you mean 2360?
2360, excuse me. I need to keep a quorum here because we do have a tap coming, and I need a quorum to do that. So if you would, if something comes up and you have to leave, let me know so we can do those.
I'm with you, Mr. Chair. I'm used to staying in this building a lot later than this.
Oh.
Yeah, House Bill 2360 eliminates ability to transfer ocean trawl, salmon, fishery permits from one vessel to another of different size category if vessels are within 5 feet in length of each other. There's no fiscal. There's no fiscal effect according to our report, no expenditure impact.
And do we have amendments?
There are no amendments.
Okay. Ms. Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Kay Brown with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. The department takes no position on this bill, but I did want to describe the bill to you a little bit. It refers to one of the several limited entry permit systems for commercial fisheries. In this case, it's troll salmon, those salmon that are taken in the ocean. And it limits the size of vessels when permits are transferred from one size of a vessel to another. It categorizes them into three separate categories and does not allow transfer within those categories. Except that if you are transferring a boat from one category to another category, it does allow it if those vessels are within 5 feet of each other. And what this bill does is eliminate that provision for the 5-foot transfer, so that vessels would be limited to those three categories, and they could not transfer in between those categories. Now, this was an industry-sponsored bill a number of years ago, and the purpose is really to prevent effort shift from smaller boats to larger boats in a fishery where the numbers of fish are somewhat limited. So we just offer those as comments to you so that you have some understanding of the bill. The impact really is very small in a very few number of boats. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
The department has no position.
That's correct.
Okay. Any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Ms. Brown. Near your closing statement, the purpose was to prevent effort shift from...
Mr. Chair, Representative Flores, the purpose is to prevent smaller boats from selling their permits to larger boats, in which case then the numbers of salmon that could be taken by that permit would gradually increase over time if you were not to restrict those vessels to the size categories that they're in.
Gotcha. Thank you.
Other questions?
Mr. Chair, if I may. It just limits it within 5 feet. So if you have a 30-foot boat and a permit, you can sell the permit to somebody with a 35-foot boat. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, there are three categories. There are vessels that are less than or equal to 30 feet. There's a second category that are vessels that are greater than 30 feet and less than or equal to 42 feet. And then there's a category of vessels that are greater than 42 feet. What the current law allows is that if you are in one of those three categories and your vessel's only 5 foot different from the boat that you want to sell the permit to, it would allow you to sell into a different category, but only if there's only a 5 foot difference.
So
for instance, if I had a vessel that was 30 feet and I wanted to sell it to a vessel that was 35 feet, I'd be transferring between two different categories. That would be okay because there's only a 5 foot difference between those vessels.
That's the original.
The way it is now. What this bill does is it would not allow you to transfer between those two categories. If my vessel was less than or equal to 30 feet, I could only transfer it to a vessel that was less than or equal to 30 feet.
No, I'm totally confused.
Maybe I could try.
Go ahead.
There's categories.
Got that.
Current law would allow you to shift between categories as long as it wasn't too within 5 feet.
Right. And so
this does says you can't shift between categories.
Why would you have it less or more restrictive? Is that, this makes it more restrictive, right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, that's correct.
Right.
I thought his intent in speaking to Representative Smith, he wanted to make it less restrictive.
I'm not sure. The author of the bill is not here. I'm not sure.
Saw him, about 3 hours ago.
And you didn't ask him then?
I did ask him then. I said, why would somebody from Eastern Oregon be concerned about this? And he said, may I repeat what he said?
Sure.
He said his brother had a boat and he wanted to make it easier for him to sell his permit. So this makes it more restrictive. I don't think that's what he intended at all.
That's the danger of having a brother who is a state legislator.
Right.
maybe he doesn't really like his brother. anyway, that's Valid point. I think we need to ask Representative Smith.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Representative Brown. Ms. Brown, we appreciate your patience in staying with us here. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on, this is House Bill 36. Oops, what is the number?
2360.
On House Bill 2360. And we are going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3316. And we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3616. And we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2812. And we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2812. And unless there's other business to be discussed, we will be adjourned until... Bless you.